On air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
An Australian investment fund pays $15 million for one of Woolnorth's dairies.
Generally, the farm's in reasonably good condition. I'm happy with the condition of the farm. I know we can make some good improvements to it, but I don't have anything really negative to say about it.
And the dry affecting irrigation in Tasmania.
So where we can, we have extended a number of our seasons. We made the decision, even though the Don scheme has got a designated summer and winter season, that we would be a bit more flexible than we would normally, but only for this year.
We'll have those stories and a lot more on the program today, including some winners of the Tasmanian Dairy Awards. And if you would like to comment on any of these stories, please send us a text 0438 922 936. 0438 922 936. But first, Tasmania Irrigation has extended access to summer irrigation beyond next week's scheduled closure for 12 schemes across the state. Farmers had been pressuring Tasmanian Irrigation to relax its rules around access to water so it can finish veggie crops and maintain pastures for dairy herds. The CEO, Andrew Kneebone, says it's not always possible to extend a season.
There's a wide variety of dates, but generally they would start in October, first, second week of October, and go through to the end of March. So it depends on the scheme. Some of our schemes have designated summer and winter periods. Not all of them. Most of the original schemes that were developed really would have only ever had summer seasons. And that's because generally if we've got a dam that needs to be filled, then we need to fill it over the winter period so we've got water for the summer period.
So what's been the predicament for some farmers who might be in the middle of trying to finish their crops and the deadline for the summer season ends next weekend, virtually?
Unless we've got any flexibility, they need to have a winter entitlement. Now, they don't have to actually purchase it and own it forever. They can just lease it on an annual basis if they need to. So if they desperately need water, in those cases where we only have a summer season, then we've also got a product called general availability, which means water, if it's available, can be made available, but it has to be there. It has to be available, and it's provided on an as-is, where-is, if basis.
So what are you doing in the coming weeks to extend that season, and why are you doing it?
Well, we've looked at a range of our schemes where we can do it and where we've had requests from farmers. And we're in constant contact with our irrigators through our irrigator representative committees. We also field quite a few phone calls about what's going on. So where we can, we have extended a number of our seasons. We made the decision, even though the Don scheme has got a designated summer and winter season, because it's the first year we needed and people were getting used to using the water there, that we would be a bit more flexible than we would normally, but only for this year. And we've extended that by a month to the end of April, and then we'll enter our winter season after that.
So there's 12 schemes all up that will have some sort of extension to their summer watering program.
It's about that number. Yes. Yeah. We've got a number that we can't, for various operational reasons, extend it. The Meander scheme, for instance, we can't extend that one because we've got a construction that's going, it's underway. We've got new pipelines we've got to put in. We've got pump stations that need to be upgraded, and we've got a very small window of opportunity to do that. So we've not been able to extend that particular one, but I know we're working with irrigators who desperately need water to see what flexibility we've got there.
So the other schemes that you've got, aside from Don, how long will farmers be able to participate before the winter scheme rolls over?
If they've got winter seasons, and they've historically had winter seasons, so that's the places like the Midlands, this down the south, the southeast, 2 scheme, then they would be changing over from the end of this month and they'd be into their winter allocations. It's really only the concept of extending scheme seasons is really only for those that have got summer only and where we've got some flexibility around that. We'd have to have the water. B, there'd have to be a real demand for it. And it's always a balance then between do we give people access to the water now or do we hold it back and for the next season? So it's always a balance that's got to be achieved. It's very difficult. We understand things are tough on farmers at the moment and particularly there hasn't been anything like a break in the weather at this stage. So you know, we're always open to trying to work with people to meet their needs.
And so you do have that water to provide these farmers then?
Well, generally, we wouldn't make it available unless we did. It's either in storage or it's backed up by a hydro storage, which is a number of our schemes. Reliability of them is backed up by the by accessing water out of hydro storages.
How are those storages looking?
I don't have the figures in front of me, but generally they're looking pretty good for this time of year. We've got a couple of schemes that we are that we're generally concerned about and we keep a very close eye on. The Southern Highlands this year has been particularly dry. We had to start, last season was only a 60% allocation for that particular area because of the vagaries of their water supply and also the choices of the irrigators at the time not wishing to buy hydro water when we needed to purchase it in the winter period. The Swan is always, so down the east coast, is always a very one that's watched with eagle eyes. It's very reliant on east coast lows and on harvesting basically flood flows in the Swan River. So we've generally got between a year and a year and a half's supply in that dam, but it's always one we sweat on a little bit.
Because you're banking on those winter flows, right?
Yes, yeah.
Coming into autumn, you're comfortable, but you really can't definitively say these schemes are in strife until the end of winter.
No, so unfortunately, we need the majority, if they're not backed up by hydro storages and where we have to, say, pump or fill a dam, we don't know until we're sort of getting to the end of April, to the end of winter into spring as to what the real situation looks like. We've generally built our dams where they've got more than, if they're full, they've got more than 1 year's supply in them, but they've never rarely got more than 2 years' supply in them. So even the Meander Dam is probably down a bit. All of our storage levels are on our website, but it's probably not unusual for it to be down this time of year because they've had a full season of taking irrigation water out of them, and they do rely on pretty well an annual fill. The Craigbourne Dam down south is also probably hasn't filled this year. It's filled every year for the last 3 years, but traditionally it only fills every third year. So it's another one that we'll be keeping a very close eye on.
A couple of weeks ago, water sales for the proposed Tamar irrigation scheme closed. Do you know the outcome of that?
Unfortunately, not yet, not definitively. We're still working through the administration of all of that. We've got a range of applications, and we had to also confirm the previous applications that we had received. And now it's just going through the administration of that. But we're aiming to understand what that is and then go back out and start talking to our irrigators about what the results are and also start then putting together a business case for the scheme.
Andrew Kneebone is Chief Executive of Tasmanian Irrigation. He was speaking to Larissa Smith about extending its summer irrigation period for a number of schemes across the state. And in a statement, Hydro Tasmania says, despite the drier than average conditions over the past 6 months, their dam levels are in good shape, with energy in storage well above the prudent storage level and the high reliability level set by the energy security framework. Hydro maintains a number of downstream flow commitments from its storages, including irrigation commitments, and storage levels are more than adequate to continue meeting those commitments. And that was Hydro Tasmania. Now, overseas, and a report from overseas, over half of the expansion of irrigation worldwide since 2000 has been unsustainable. That's according to a new international study. Lead author Piyush Mita from the University of Delaware says Australia was in the top 10 countries worldwide when it came to irrigation expansion levels.
We found that the irrigation expanded by about 11% in the past 15 years, and about 52% of this irrigation was unsustainable, and it took place in locations already experiencing some form of water stress.
And how did Australia rate in your study?
Yeah. So Australia was also, it was really interesting. It was because it was among the top 10 countries that had the most irrigation in the world. And we found that Australia saw an increase by 41%. That is about 1.5 million hectares of irrigated areas from 2000. So it was 3.6 million hectares in 2000 and 5.1 million hectares in 2015. And we also found that 57% of this irrigation expansion that happened happened in already blue water stress regions in Australia. So there were a lot of places that unsustainable irrigation expansion happened, and that trend might continue to happen. So we would like to inform the decision makers to try to irrigate somewhere else.
Yeah, were there any particular regions that were at fault?
Yeah. So we looking at mostly, we found that so Murray-Darling Basin, that covers parts of New South Wales and Victoria. It's a significant region because it contributes a lot of agricultural output and provides one third of the agriculture, Australia's food supply. So we saw a lot of increase in irrigation intensity there in that region, and particularly in the southeast. And I also know that a lot of irrigation is done there, and crops like cotton, citrus, almonds are grown, and a lot of water intensive crops are grown in that region. So we found that area particularly saw a lot of unsustainable irrigation and increase of intensity of irrigation and unsustainable irrigation. So from this data set, we can exactly pinpoint what exactly areas that are facing water stress, and we can point out to some of the potential areas that can in future be used to irrigate instead.
Yeah, so according to your study, Australia might really have to pull back in some of its water usage.
Yeah. I also researched that around 72% of the agricultural production is exported in Australia. So it's a global food exporter, and continued unsustainable irrigation practices could force a reduction in food exports. It could also result in less water that is available for future agricultural needs. And sustainable irrigation is particularly important in these countries because if a failure of water resources would potentially have cascading effects on these nations, and thus ensuring the irrigation expansion happen only in places where water resources are abundant is really important and could avoid these undesirable outcomes.
And that was PhD candidate Piyush Mehta from the University of Delaware speaking with Elsie Adamo. Now, the breakup of Australia's biggest dairy farm continues, with Melbourne-based fund manager Prime Value buying another part of the Woolnorth dairy operation from Chinese-backed operator Van Dairy Group after it lost a $25 million milk contract with dairy giant Fonterra. Meg Powell spoke to Prime's Kirsty Keitley.
It's a good deal. The farm is currently been run as an organic farm, so we'll be actually switching that over to conventional, but it has good infrastructure on it, so I'm very happy with the deal that we've got.
What's the condition of the farm? I know many of the farms at Woolnorth have had effluent problems. Tim Roberts-Thompson, who has also bought inside the gate, has said some of his farms needed a lot of work. What are you looking at there?
Well, it's actually the effluent's been done. It's actually licensed to milk 600 cows. So if in the future we're probably looking more likely to be milking 900 to 1,000 cows, so we'll have to do some work on the effluent system to increase the cow numbers. But the current effluent system is fine. Generally, the farm's in reasonably good condition. So a lot of the farms that you buy, you wind up spending some capex on them, and we've done a lot of capital works on our farms that we've bought off various vendors, whether it's building new cow sheds or putting new laneways in or irrigation in. But I'm happy with the condition of the farm. I know we can make some good improvements to it, but I don't have anything really negative to say about it.
Vanderi recently, it lost its milk deal. It's been culling its herds. Talks are that more farms will be up for sale. Are you looking to expand your portfolio even further than this one?
Not this current portfolio. So we're actually looking at closing. This farm is our last purchase in this portfolio. So we started in December 2019. We have enough land now across Victoria and Tasmania to milk the 10,000 cows, and that was our aim. We also have enough land to be able to run our support, our heifers and our calves, and make our own hay and silage. So we're looking at closing. We're closing this farm at the end of June, end of the financial year.
Well, as you alluded to, Justine, it's not your first foray into Wool North. You bought some farms outside the gate a couple of years ago. How are those going?
Really, really happy with them. So what I did with that portfolio, I was able to buy some neighbouring farms off different vendors, and we've basically taken farms that were milking sort of 450 cows, turned them into bigger farms, and they're now ranging between 800 and sort of 1,200 cow farms. So we've increased, and this year we've just completed our third rotary dairy. We're on the construction of our fourth rotary dairy, which has meant that we have been able to take our stocking rate from 2 cows per hectare to 3 cows per hectare. We've also put in some irrigation infrastructure with huge new effluent ponds. We're spreading effluent over a larger area. And so they're going really, really well. We're kind of two-thirds through our capital expenditure. We're just finishing off a couple of projects now. So then it's just sort of settled down and run them. But I'm very happy with the way they're going. Production's up 35% on last year. But more than that, it's not just about the production. You can have production up, but we're getting control on our costs, and we're dropping a lot of our costs. We're very much a pasture-based system, so we're really reliant on growing as much grass as possible, the cheapest form of feed. So that's what we concentrate on. And then just top up with grains, hay and silage when we need to. But I couldn't be happier with the way they're going. It's been a lot of hard work. It's been very busy over a short period of time. But, really wrapped at who we are at this stage.
How much are you calculating you will have spent on in the northwest area maybe by the end of June, July?
$12 to $13 million.
Right.
On new infrastructure?
Oh, yeah. All up, maybe this Wool North project.
All up.
Yeah.
Well, the fund when we close will be worth $230 million. So that's kind of where we are. And two-thirds of that is in Tasmania. We only have two farms in southwest Victoria, so the bulk of that is in Tasmania. So, yeah, it's been a fair amount of money in the northwest region.
An extraordinary amount of investment. And are you confident it will pay off?
Oh, definitely. I wouldn't have done it if I wasn't. So I've known the area for a long time. You know, we've got moderate climate. It doesn't get too hot. We've got reliable rainfall. We've got good irrigation water. I think, and I farmed in Australia and in New Zealand, and I think it's some of the best farming land in the world for growing pasture. There's not many places in the world left that actually produce milk from pasture, and Tasmania can do that. It's got the freshest air. It's got the cleanest water in the world. I think it's a great place. And there's plenty of people who are there already farming who are very successful farmers. You only need to look at what they're doing. We're just keeping it simple. Like I said, we're a pasture-based system. We're concentrating on controlling our costs and keeping our costs under control. We're employing, we have a workforce of about 68 people in Tasmania, not including some of the more senior staff. So we're employing a lot of local people. We've put a lot of money into that community, and I'm more than happy to do so. And we're really sort of really looking forward to watching those farms prosper and the fund do really well for its investors.
And that was Prime Dairy Investment Manager Kirsty Keitley talking about their $15 million acquisition of another Woolnorth dairy farm in far northwest Tasmania. Now, Farmer, just in his second season as manager, has won the 2024 Tasmanian Dairy Business of the Year for Dalmore Dairy. Mahesh Gampala started dairy farming in 2019 after moving from India to complete his Master's in Ag Science at the University of Tasmania. He spoke to Meg Powell about his journey and why his attention to detail on pastures, teamwork and the farm's performance impressed the judges.
I've always been into farming, agriculture. I've done my bachelor's in ag science back in India, and I've wanted to initially be an entrepreneur in something towards ag businesses. I thought my bachelor's and the jobs I had back in India were good enough, or I don't know. I was looking for something else and had to come to Tasmania to do my master's and sort of started there. To put it in a way, I'm a farmer by choice, but dairy farming was just an accident.
How did you accidentally fall into dairy farming?
So I was doing my master's here and looking for opportunities. I was sort of looking for a bigger role. So let's say I wanted to do something for myself to build or start my career in anything. And I was talking to one of my professors and everything, and I've done a thesis and a research project on dairy. One was on particle size distribution in concentrates in dairying. And that sort of drifted me towards dairying. And I thought I'd give it a crack as a farmhand and see how it goes. And I liked it from there. And this is where I am now.
It went very, very well, obviously. So you started as a farmhand and you built your way up to becoming the manager of a dairy. Can you just tell me a bit about the dairy and your journey there?
Yeah, so I've started at Northeast at one of farm owner called Andrew Aldridge, and he referred to me corporates, BWB, or I'd say corporate or whatever. It's a BWB group. They have 9 farms. I sort of asked him, I was on 3-month training period or calving assistance or whatever. He taught me more than calving or breeding calves. And at end of 3 months contract, I asked him if he's got more work. But at that point, he didn't have much work, but he referred to one of his friends or my bosses, current bosses, and he referred me there. And they interviewed me and gave me a job as a trainee to B2IC at Dalmore, where I am now. And I worked my way up from there, and we had an opportunity. I worked on at Dalmore for about a year and a half. They bought a new farm, and my current manager had to move on to manage the next farm, and I've been given this position.
It's obviously worked very well for you because you've won Dairy Business of the Year. Congratulations.
Yeah, no, thank you. But yeah, that was a bit of a surprise, but yeah, done my part. That's about it, I know.
You were recognised partly for your attention to detail, is something the judges noted. How would you describe your approach to managing the farm?
I actually like pasture walks. It lets you look the whole farm every week, and you can pay attention to something's going wrong, or you actually can see everything. I've been doing pasture walks for the last 4 years. And yeah, obviously I come from ag science background, so I'm a bit more interested in how the pastures behave and how are they performing.
What have been some of the hardest things for you to learn stepping up into this role?
During the COVID? That was my first year of managing, and we literally didn't find people on farm. So myself and back then my mentor, there was Paul Loder and another worker. 3 of us virtually used to run the farm. And we did that for the whole year. So it was about 3 people milking cows. We had another casual here and there. But that was the toughest year to manage the farm in terms of working all the time and trying to make decisions at the same time when you're working.
Meanwhile, a global pandemic going on and you don't know what's happening.
Yeah, no, that's it. That kind of tested me for a year. So I suppose we must have come off it pretty well, I'd say. And since then, we had a pretty good team, and everyone seems to be happy on farm.
What's your favourite thing about being a dairy farmer? It's not a career you necessarily envisioned for yourself, but one that you've obviously fallen into and thrived in so far.
I like plants or grass or anything, pretty much green. That's kind of the basis to everything. So I'm always looking at grasses, and if they're growing, I'm happy, and if they're not, I'm thinking why it's not growing. But I would say that's my strengths and I'm interested in. And that's the key driver for the production of cows and everything and the profits. I like working with people. So I take pride in managing people or working with people. And I'm a very good team player, in my personal opinion, taking part in everything on farm. And I'm not a manager who leads people to do all the jobs or anything like that. I'm mostly with them doing the jobs instead of asking them to do or telling them to do it. That's about it. See, I'm just a team player.
That was Mahesh Kampala from Dalmore Dairy, the winner of this year's Tasmanian Dairy Business of the Year, and all three finalists in the category hailed from Dairy Plains in the Meander Valley. Time for the news headlines now with Will Murray.
Good afternoon, Fiona. Tasmanian Labor leader Rebecca White says decisions about the future of the party leadership will be made in the coming weeks after conceding defeat at the state election. Neither of the major parties will reach the required 18 seats to form majority, with the Liberals currently on 13 and Labor on 10. Yesterday, Ms. White said it was clear the Liberals would win more seats and be asked by the governor to form minority government with support from the crossbench. King Charles's nephew says the monarch's recovery after a cancer diagnosis is taking longer than he intended. Last month, Buckingham Palace announced the 75-year-old king had been diagnosed with an unspecified form of cancer. Peter Phillips, who is the son of Princess Anne, says the king is frustrated at the pace of his recovery. And the Jack Jumpers defeated Melbourne United 93-91 in a nail-biting game at John Cain Arena last night. A half-court shot from Jack McVeigh seconds before the end of the game places the Jack Jumpers just one win away from a maiden NBL title. Jack Jumpers coach Scott Roth says he expects a war when United come back to Hobart for Game 4 on Thursday. More news at 1.
Thank you, Will. Time to cross to the Weather Bureau now, and good afternoon, Matthew Thomas.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, has there been much rainfall overnight?
Look, there was some rain in the westerly stream. So 2:09 a.m, most of the rain was about the west. 46 millimetres at Lake Margaret was the highest total there. Moving away from the west, there were some smaller falls into the northwest with around 4.5 millimetres at Smithton and 4 millimetres at Sisters Beach, and then sort of a millimetre or two through the Upper Derwent Valley, and about sort of 1 to 3 millimetres down in the Huon, and generally less than a millimetre elsewhere about central and southern parts, and also about the northeast.
All right. Now, can you tell me what's happening with the outlook?
So we've got a fairly vigorous westerly stream over the state at the moment. So we do still have some gusty winds about central and southern parts of the state. Those winds are expected to begin to ease back through the afternoon. There is a severe weather warning, just warning of potentially damaging wind gusts about parts of the Upper Derwent Valley, the Huon, and then the Central Plateau and into the southeast forecast. Districts. So that is likely to be cancelled in the next few hours. So if people want to look at any more details, that's on our website. But those winds are easing back, but we're still maintaining a westerly stream. So the showers will predominantly be about the west and far south of the state. And we're looking there at another sort of 10 perhaps 15 millimetres about parts of the west, but generally about the far south, we're looking at sort of 0 to 2 millimetres out of those showers. We might also just see some showers pushing through the Bass Strait Islands as well. And we'll maintain a fairly similar flow into tomorrow, but with the shower activity just easing back slightly as the the stream does ease as well. But we will see around 2 to 10 millimetres generally about the west, 10 to 15 millimetres possible about elevated locations. And into the south east, we might just see sort of 0 to 2 millimetres about the far south, so through the Huon and over Bruny Island. And largely fine conditions elsewhere. Just maybe some light showers about the Furneaux Islands as well, sort of 0 to 2 millimetres. Into Wednesday, that high pressure system begins to approach, and the stream showers into the west really ease back, and we're looking at sort of around sort of 1 to 5 millimetres about the west. And far south, and not terribly much elsewhere. And with the high pressure system then moving over Tasmania on Thursday into Friday, we might see areas of valley fog. Not terribly much in the way of precipitation though on either of those 2 days. Fairly light winds.
All right. Can you tell me if there's any warnings?
So in terms of warnings, we do have a few. So we've got that severe weather warning for damaging winds about parts of the west and southwest of the state. There's a gale warning that's current for all coastal waters except for the western coast and the upper east coast. So we're looking there at for northern, eastern and southern coastal waters from Stanley to Low Rocky Point, excluding the upper east coast. Strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters, for the southwest lakes and also for Storm Bay, the Channel and Frederick Henry and Norfolk Bays. And in terms of the coastal waters, with a fairly vigorous westerly stream, we've got westerly winds of 20 to 30 knots about the west and the upper east coast, and reaching 30 to 40 knots about remaining waters. But those winds will begin to ease back into the afternoon and falling back to 20 to 25 knots about western waters into the evening. Into Tuesday, we'll see westerly winds of 20 to 30 knots, reaching 30 to 35 knots about the south at times during the day, but only reaching 10 to 20 knots about the upper east coast. With the swells, the wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel is showing a significant wave of 6.2 metres and a maximum wave of 8.3 metres in a 14-second period. With the around the west and the south, we're expecting a west to southwesterly swell of 5 to 7 metres. It's slowly going to decay through today and tomorrow and be 3 to 4 metres by tomorrow evening. That similar decay is happening about the north, where we've got a westerly of 1.5 to 2 metres decaying down to 0.5 to 1.5 metres by tomorrow, and about the east, a southerly of 2 to 3.5 metres decaying down to 1.5 to 2 metres tomorrow.
All right, Matthew Thomas, thanks so much.
See you later, bye.
Cedric S. Ben Sump here to remind you to join HG and Roy as they throw the rugby league carcass onto the slab and forensically examine the entrails. Remember, rugby league has known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns wrapped in a fine gossamer of mystery.
Bludging on the Blind Side with HG Nelson and rampaging Roy Slaven. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, there's downward pressure on merino wool prices across the country as large volumes continue to hit auction floors. And that means buyers can afford to be picky with what they're bidding for. Wool broker George Nichols told Larissa Smith it's a buyer's market.
Well, not a huge amount of positivity last week. Overall, we were down 15 cents on the EMI. For the week, settling it at 11.52 cents a kilo, so not hugely positive, which is down about 13% year on year.
Yeah, I think 23 microns were the only sort of merino category that saw a lift in price.
Yeah, cardings, merino cardings went they saw a slight lift as well. So basically, we're just looking at a huge volume of wool on the market now, and has been over the last couple of weeks, and we were up last week as well. Combined that with the Aussie dollar and a few other, monetary indicators that wool seems to follow, and some other commodity pricing, we're not in a very, it's not an uplifting week last week.
Is that typical for this time of year to see a larger volume of wool in March?
Yeah, it is. This year we've seen a lot, but yeah, we're seeing, you know, we've sort of been through a busy period. There's a lot of lambs being shorn through this period, and yeah, no, typically we do see an uplift in production on or wools to be offered at this time of year, and I think a lot of it probably is to do as well with growers in the wool market are often, you know, that they're both in the wool market and the livestock market, and we're seeing probably not the peaks in the livestock red meat pricing, so they're probably looking at selling a bit of wool, you know, to supplement that sort of loss of income, I suppose. You'd make an assumption that could be the case as well.
And at the other buying end, what's driving that sort of lacklustre interest, say, from China or out of Europe?
It's pretty simple at the moment. It's supply and demand working in favour of the buyers. When there's that much wool up on offer, they can pick and choose and take the quality that they want. So at the moment we're just in a glut of supply, and really it's, you know, just simple sort of supply and demand economics that are causing where we're at the moment. I mean, China's in a difficult position at the moment when, you know, they're not overly excited about spending at the moment, and that's been the case for a while now, but that's sort of where we're suffering, and when there's this much wool on offer, the total for the week was 44,000 bales, which is 2,500 bales up week on week. So it's pretty simple economics, really.
And locally, dry conditions continue to persist across the state. What does the prolonged dry do to the fleece?
Dryness, you know, obviously dust, lack of grass, so it'll increase dirt content in the wool. Producers are getting pretty good at feeding their livestock now, so hopefully we can look at, you know, some relatively good consistent wools when it's dry, because you can manage the sheep's nutritional intake. But really it's probably reduced yields due to things like dust and dirt in the wool. It's not ideal. Every single person involved in any sort of agriculture in Australia or Tasmania, sorry, at the moment is probably doing a pretty good rain dance.
Yes, you included.
Absolutely, yeah, without a doubt.
So you're based in the south of the state.
Yes.
That would you say that's it's really copping it in the sort of centre there around you know around Bothwell and up in the Highlands?
Without a doubt. My role's state based, but I've got a lot of clients. You know, most of my clients are based around that area in the Derwent Valley and the Bothwell area, and I've been around the state a couple of times in the last few weeks. The whole state is phenomenally dry. There's normally you find a good corner here and there, but I've been in the northwest and I didn't see much grass up there. The northeast, there's not a lot of grass, and you continue to get south and the Bothwell sort of Hollow Tree, Derwent Valley area, yeah, which is traditionally a dry area this time of year, but yeah, it's pretty dry. There's not a lot of green, well, there's no green. There's a lot of dry dams and a lot of feed cuts. You'd be lucky to find a corner of Tassie at the moment where someone doesn't have some form of hay feeder or grain feeder on the back of a ute or a tractor. You know, even the islands, Flinders and King Island are in a fair bit of pain at the moment. And, you know, we're seeing some pretty significant logistical issues shifting animals and fodder around the state and interstate at the moment. So we'll continue to try and work through all those issues and come out the other side.
And that was George Nichols. He's the head of Nutrien's Wool Division. Now, staying with wool, and a bill was unanimously passed by France's lower house to impose penalties on ultra-fast fashion products, which are often made from synthetic materials, so not wool, I should say. Key measures, including a ban on advertising for the cheapest textiles, and targets low-cost items for their environmental footprint. Warwick Long spoke to Pierre Condamine from Friends of the Earth France, who is campaigning for this change. He says this is a big deal for France, but also the world.
There was a law that was voted last week, and it is sort of historic because the law was voted unanimously, and also it is quite ambitious in the way it tries to tackle fast fashion. So what it does is that it defines fast fashion through the frequency of renewal of collections or of new models, just like, you know, brands like Shein are actually putting more than 7,000 new models on their website every day. And so based on this, it is like adding penalty to the definition of fast fashion. So if you are sort of practicing fast fashion for a brand, you would get some financial penalties that you'll have to pay, and it's up to 10 euros in 2030. So that's something quite big that would disturb the model of fast fashion that is, you know, relying on high quantity of clothes sold at very little prices.
So this is effectively a tax or a charge up to 10 euros per item of fast fashion clothing that people are trying to sell in France.
Yeah, it's not really a tax. It's more of a charge, let's say, because it applies to the producer, to the brands, not to the consumers. But then, of course, we know that the brands is likely to move it to consumers, but it's really a penalty on a bad practice that you would have as a brand.
And who decides what is fast fashion and what is not?
So that is a bit of the blur around the law, is that the threshold that would make you, you know, fast fashion is not defined yet. The threshold has to be defined later in a decree that will be taken by the Environment Ministry. We hope that, yeah, this will lead to ambitious threshold and not only to, you know, only a few of the worst brand being considered in the threshold.
So the law will set the framework, if you will, but that detail is still to be decided.
Exactly. But we hope that if we want it to be efficient, it will be a large perimeter.
And where are your efforts to get this law passed currently standing? So it's passed the lower house of French Parliament. Do you still need to get it through the Senate? Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So it was adopted in the first reading in the National Assembly by the MPs, and now it has to be adopted by the Senate. And that's something we fear a bit, because we know the Senate is much more conservative than the National Assembly. So we hope that we'll still manage to get an ambitious text after the Senate vote, and that the government will keep supporting the bill as it is.
What is I don't know French politics. What's the timeline like for getting something through the Senate and ultimately trying to make it law?
So this is something that is not clear yet, but this bill was tabled a month and a half ago. So it's extremely fast for something that ambitious. And we can hope that by summer, you know, by June, it will be adopted, because the government has shown support for the bill, and it has asked for a fast procedure around its adoption. So we can hope really that by June it's adopted, and then can be enforced at the beginning of 2025.
Can you give me the big picture? What do you hope this legislation achieves? What are you trying to change here?
You know, the problem with fast fashion is the quantity of clothes that are produced, because we know that 80% of the environmental impact is due to production phase. So we know that this model really relies on producing a large quantity of clothes and then selling it at very low prices. And so, you know, the social impacts that we know during the production phase. So what we hope is that if producers have to pay a bit more, and even sometimes not only a bit more, but like 5 to 10 euros, you know, the system cannot work anymore and have to reduce the level of production that they have right now.
And that was Pierre Condamine from Friends of the Earth in France. Now, Australia's peak wool industry has welcomed the world's first bill passing the lower house in France last week, which could shift global textiles markets in favour of natural fibres. Key measures include a ban on advertising for the cheapest textiles and targets low-cost items for the environmental footprint. Australia Wool Innovation CEO John Roberts says the devil will be in the detail, but says if the bill passes the Senate, it will be a great market opportunity for wool.
I think on the surface it looks very encouraging from a wool grower perspective. You know, there's a proposed impost on ultra-fast fashion, which is going to obviously, and obviously a ban on advertising of fast fashion. What constitutes those levels of fast fashion needs to be seen, but on the surface I think it looks pretty positive for natural fibres like wool.
So one of the major reasons that this law has been put into place is there's a large environmental impact of fast fashion textiles. What are the benefits going to be for natural fibres, do you think, in that market now?
Oh, look, I think, you know, what's interesting now is, and we've been on this journey for over a decade as a wool industry, trying to actually put forward the eco-credentials of wool and actually counter some of the greenwashing that's been happening in the fashion space for a long period of time. And I think what's nice is that some of our efforts are starting to be realised. I mean, we did our campaign of Wear Wool, Not Fossil Fuel 2 years ago now, and I think some of the results of that are starting to permeate in big wool growing or wool consuming nations like France.
What will this bill mean for Australian exporters if it is passed in the Senate, do you think?
I think ultimately it'll be reflected in the wool auction rooms of Australia. I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time competing against man-made fibres, and those man-made fibre brands have you know, marketing budgets that dwarf ours. I mean, they are giants, and I think if they aren't able to advertise and push and potentially greenwash in some of these situations in terms of their eco credentials, and wool's able to stand on its own two feet fairly, I think that's going to overwhelm the demand, and that should actually be reflected in the prices that exporters pay in the auction room.
If France passes a law like this, how significant is that to Australia's export market?
Oh, look, it's very significant. I mean, France, per head, have been a significant user of wool for generations. So, and they're a highly influential market. Their brands are some of the most influential in the world. So to have that... have a market like France, a huge wool-consuming market, to do this is very significant. I'm not going to start popping corks just yet. I think the important thing is the devil's in the detail, and we do want to understand exactly what defines some of these and how these categories of ultra-fast fashion versus fast fashion, and what the methodologies for measuring these eco-credentials are. I think that's important, but it certainly augurs very well at this stage.
So do you think Australia should consider similar legislation?
Oh, well, I think they are. My understanding is there was the Seamless Act has been proposed by the current government. So I think similar actions are being looked at in Australia.
And do you think these laws could influence consumer spending long term?
Absolutely. I mean, if the consumer has got to be it's becoming increasingly discerning. And we know that the Gen Zs of this world are going to be label turners, much more so than the previous ones who had more of a faith in a brand. People are actually prostituting brands a lot more these days. So if people can start looking at fibres and ingredients that go into garments and understand the truth about eco-credentials, I think it will all go very well for the industry, for the wool industry in particular.
What about the cost of living, though? We know that a lot of people can't afford much at the moment. So if fast fashion isn't in the market anymore, do you think people will be able to afford natural fibres?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, you look at what's happening when in some of the survey work that's been done. A lot of people are adopting that philosophy of buy once, buy well, rather than this high turnover, high churn of low garments, dispensing them, wastefulness, these sorts of things. So the philosophy of buy once, buy well. Yes, it might be a higher price point at the beginning, but ultimately the consumer saves money longer term. That is certainly a philosophy that's being adopted in a lot of those markets. So I'm not sure it's going to impact us too badly, actually. It might actually benefit us.
Australian Wool Innovation CEO John Roberts speaking to Jane McNaughton. Now, the very best of young auctioneers have been crowned at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Justin Oakenfield of Inverell in northern New South Wales took out the 2024 National Young Auctioneer title. Lara Webster caught up with him as he walked off the stage.
I can see the smile on your face, but I tell you, Justin, when it was mentioned and when they announced you were the national champ, I think the sweat was pouring off you by the time that announcement came through. What was it like when you heard your name called out?
It was a big shock to start with and a very big thrill. It's an honour and a privilege to receive it and be crowned the champion, and it's just been awesome.
Going into the competition, how confident were you were going to take the title?
No, I wasn't confident at all, to be honest. It was business as usual, and you know, tried our best to prepare for it, and just lucky enough to get away with it today.
You had a big crowd up there, but not one of you looked nervous at all. I suspect you all have very good poker faces, but what was it like when you were standing up there and you got to that final steer? What were you thinking by then?
Oh, to be honest, not much. It was just, you know, obviously your first one always goes quicker, then you've got to try and regroup and get into your second and really finish on a high with the third. But it was, I'm lucky enough to have been down here a couple of times in the New South Wales comp, so I've had a little bit of experience with the crowd and the amphitheatre, but it's certainly a nerve-wracking experience and you need to, you know, learn how to control your nerves.
So what does this mean for you going forward? National champion, you get to go over to the Calgary Stampede. World championships. What does that feel like to know that's where you're headed next, the world championships?
It's, like I said, very humbled and honoured. It's just still surreal, and words can't explain how I feel.
So what happens now to make sure you're as prepared as every other auctioneer that ends up there?
Oh, I'll talk one of my best mates, well, he is my best mate, he won it last year, Harry Waters, so I'd say 1,000 phone calls with him.
Have a good coach.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, we had another local runner-up from Manila, Michael Pirtle.
Yeah.
Two from the northwest. Not bad going.
Yeah, no, it's very good for our area and awesome for New South Wales to retain the team shield. It was very good.
My name's Darcy Howard. I'm based at Cowra, but work for MCC Chudley Dobell at Forbes, and I've been lucky enough to win the 2024 State Young Auctioneers competition for New South Wales. So,
let's just start with what it feels like to be able to say that.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. It's something I definitely didn't expect, but I just feel so privileged and so honoured to receive this award. You look back at some of the people that have won this award in past years, and to have my name on the trophy with the likes of some of those agents, I just so honoured and I just got so many people to thank, and it's awesome.
What does it mean for you and your work as an auctioneer going forward now?
It's obviously notching your belt. You know, being an agent for me, it's more than being an auctioneer. It's, you know, it's doing a good job for your clients and their businesses. But you know, it's just to be recognised in this way is so, you know, such a privilege.
And that was at the Sydney Easter Show and Young Auctioneers, their young national winners. Time now to talk to Joel Reinberger. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Fiona. Do you have a wood heater at your house?
Yeah, a small one, yes.
Do you use it a lot?
Only in the dead of winter, because we've also got a heat pump.
Ours is exactly the same. We've got a heat pump, but occasionally on a really cold, particularly a cold weekend,
yes,
if you can start and keep it on Friday night and keep it burning across the weekend, that's lovely. Yeah. And that's the day you want to do all the washing.
Yes.
So because you put it in front of you hang it in front of the fire, and 5 minutes later it's dry. It's amazing. Beautiful. We still love our wood heaters in Tasmania. Mm. But if you've got one, now is the time to actually start thinking about it. Because winter is well and truly on its way. I've had to wear a jacket across a lot of the weekend. And so, do you have wood?
Well, we cut our own.
So you're okay.
We're okay. I mean, you've got to do that job, but we're okay, yeah.
But the other one is, have you had your chimney swept recently?
No.
How long has it been? How much creosote has built up there? Are you going to end up with a fire? I mean, my house is 180 years old as well, so, you know, everything is old. So
yes,
you've got to have this stuff maintained.
Have you had it done?
We had ours done sort of middle of last winter because we had some issues with the chimney. And so it got swept and they fixed up the cap thing on top of the chimney for us as well. Had to find a replacement for that.
But they'd have to do it from the top down. I mean, they can't climb up a wood heater.
No, exactly not. Exactly right. And so, yeah, we're going to be talking to a chimney sweep about what needs doing and how often it needs doing and the sort of problems they see. Because you also get possums move into chimneys.
Yes.
All sorts of creepy crawlies get moved into chimneys. And you try and light it that first time. It's blocked, so you've got a house full of smoke and there's funnel webs pouring out of the... out of the chimney. So we're going to talk about chimney sweeping with a chimney sweep. We've also got Hannah Maloney from Gardening Australia coming in.
Oh, I love Hannah.
She's wonderful. And she's officially coming in to talk to us about their holiday special, which is coming up on Friday, the Easter holiday special.
Oh, cool. But Gardening Australia.
On Gardening Australia. Oh, but I reckon you can sneak in a question for her. If you've got one of those, send me a text now.
I have one. I'll give it to you later.
Do so.
Thank you, Joel Reinberger. Now, make sure, coming up on the Country Hour tomorrow, Tasmania's farmers will talk about how they're going to deal with a coalition government, and we'll talk more about drought. And for more rural news and features, you can head to the ABC Rural Facebook page.
With the ABC Listen app, you can take ABC Radio Hobart anywhere, from the car to the cafe, from the couch to the creek. Even places that don't start with a C. Download the free ABC Listen app today.